So that's it for money and markets and Ask Catherine. The rest of the questions will defer to Franklin. Just please, if you have questions for Franklin, make sure you post them up on the teleseminar software, and I'll make sure to read them to him live as we go. So with that, Franklin from South Carolina, are you with us?
I sure am. How are you?
Well, you sent me the Constitutional Court today, and you know, I'm used to it. It's gotten pretty hard to appall you, but that one really did get under your craw.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, that's not exactly what you call German precision. And the Constitutional Court to say there's a high probability this is constitutional, isn't their job to say whether it is or not, and not to give us odds like some tout at a racetrack? I don't get it.
Well, it's called a Constitutional Court. I mean, that's
right. They don't know whether it's constitutional or not. It's probably constitutional. Yeah, go ahead and do it. But I want to, since you mentioned that, I want to bring up a couple of points about that. And first of all, I'd like to tie together what the German Constitutional Court did in conjunction with what Draghi was doing a few days ago, Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, Bernanke, because the point of both of those moves is to bail out the banks. In the case of Europe, they've got to buy the bad sovereign debt that the European banks own. In the United States, Bernanke's going to buy what? Mortgage-backed securities.
He's going to buy the mortgage-backed securities.
Well, he's going to suck all that stuff out of the banks, off all those bad assets off the bank's balance sheet. So what's happened is we've got the garbage can method of taking care of financial problems. It's the same thing they did with the savings and loan deal blow up in the late 80s, early 90s. They created the Resolution Trust Corporation, which took over all the bad assets and gave them time to feed it out so that the taxpayers wound up paying the bill.
Oh, but can I just hold up there? When the Resolution Trust Corporation, first of all, they sell them at auction, so they let the market clear. The second thing is they allowed the fraudulent files to be purchased at open auction. This time, they're not allowing that, so those files are being shredded in the basement of the Fed. That's number one. So the protection this time of the fraud is enormous, and they're not letting the market clear. So this is much worse. As bad as that was, and I don't disagree with you how bad it was, this is much, much worse.
But these are both the garbage can method of dealing with bad financial assets. And the European Stability Mechanism is a completely impossible garbage can. Listen, these are published statistics. It's supposed to have 700 billion euros in it, okay? And if you get a list of all the European countries and the ones that are going to participate, there are four, the top four, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, makes up 77.3% of the contributions to the bailout fund. And of that, Germany is supposed to give 190 billion euros, while Italy and Spain together are supposed to give 30%, which is 209 billion euros, more than Germany. In other words, I want to make this perfectly clear. Italy and Spain are bankrupt, but they are going to contribute more than Germany to the bailout fund for Italy and Spain. It's a perpetual motion machine. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. It is a perpetual motion machine. Those four economies are more than three-quarters of the whole European Union. And so the idea that they can if they can do that, then I can climb in a tub and tug on the handles and pull myself up to the ceiling. It's the same exact thing. Then Bernanke's going to buy $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities a month. He said, okay, to be fair, he said up to $40 billion a month. Until when? Forever. Until the unemployment numbers
Right. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you look at what is happening with government policy, the government is doing everything it can with fiscal policy and trade policy to increase unemployment. And, of course, technology is doing the same. So if you look at what we're doing with technology as a society, and then you look at government regulatory and trade policy, you know, on one hand, the government is doing everything it possibly can to grow unemployment. And at the same time, we have the central bank saying they're going to print until unemployment calms down, you know, it drops. So there's a multiple personality disorder here.
But let me just nail one thing down. They can buy all the mortgage-backed securities they want. They can do all the stimulus programs they want. That does not work. And they ought to be adult enough to know it does not work. But they're like a bunch of communists sitting around in a concentration camp saying Comrade Stalin doesn't know. It's not that Comrade Stalin doesn't know. It's that the system works this way. So the main thing is, though, that these two actions are tied together by a bank bailout. They're both bailing out the banks. And we have to be clear about that. It's the banks that have a problem. It's not as much the economies as it is the banks, because they've loaned all this money and they've got this bad paper that they have to get rid of some way or the other. But more than that, for the primary trend and for our long-term strategy, there's one conclusion that we can draw from these actions, and that is they have proved again that they will inflate, and they will keep on inflating and keep on inflating. And since we know that monetary demand drives silver and gold, we know, in other words, that Ben Bernanke and Mario Draghi are the best friends that gold and silver have, because they're the ones driving up the price. So all that's necessary to happen is for them to continue to inflate. So anyway, I looked at all that and I just sort of shook my head. But, you know, this is what we've expected that they would do. And none of it makes any sense that I can figure out. But can we talk about currencies a little bit?
Yeah, so let's step back and just catch us up on what's happened with gold and silver since we spoke last.
Well, let me come around the long way and talk about currencies first.
Okay.
It's very interesting to me. If you look at it, a long-term chart of the U.S. dollar index that goes back to 2010, the end of 2010, you see that a channel starts there, and that channel contains all of the movement from then until now. And a lot of times a channel will have a center line or middle line. And when a market flips when it goes through that center line, it tends to go all the way through to the line either above or below. In the dollar's case, it's the line below. So the dollar has come down to the bottom of the trading channel in just a very few months, to the bottom of the trading channel that had been in place since December of 2011. Now it's headed for probably 78 if it doesn't stop here. Let me tell you the reason why I think it might stop here. Right now, if you look at the exchange rates for the yen and the euro, one U.S. dollar costs 77.5 yen, and one U.S. dollar costs 77.02 euros. And this is the same band they've kept them in. It's just that the dollar had gotten too high in that band, so they brought it down from around 80 or a little over 80 down to this 77 range. It may stop here. This may be a sufficient adjustment for them, because the euro is now back up to $1.30, I think, today, nearly $1.30. So this may be the end of it. And, of course, the decline of the dollar, these announcements of planned inflation, is what is driving the silver and gold market. One thing that has to be pointed out is that when Bernanke made this announcement, the yield on the 30-year bond dropped. And he's kept those yields, he's kept those interest rates low for a long time. Now he's working against himself. Talk about multiple personality disorder. With one hand, he says, I'm going to keep interest rates low. With the other hand, he says, I'm going to print more money. Well, you can't do that. that doesn't work. When people know you're going to print more money, they demand a bigger interest rate. So I think for a while the dollar's relation to the yen and euro is going to be probably not going to change a whole lot. That doesn't mean that silver and gold won't go up. What we've seen silver and gold do is stage an astonishing rally. And, you know, I'm confident that a lot of what Bernanke was planning on doing was already priced into the market by anticipation. If that hadn't been the case, instead of jumping $38.50 today to $1,769.10, well, they've had these enormous moves up. Silver from $27 to $34.71.60 today, moved 148.3 cents today, gold up $38.50 today, and those moves have fulfilled my targets. There's a lot of strong resistance against gold at $1,800, and so I think that this is the time to sit back, not to buy, but to wait for the reaction from this climb, and that will be the safest, cheapest place you'll ever buy. That's the first correction in a move up, and it'll probably, you know, it's hard to say from here where it will go, but probably $30 with gold and maybe $1,640 with silver. Vice versa, I suspect.
Well, you know, I'm grappling with, as we always are, is with folks who have not yet purchased and are trying to make a decision as to whether they go in now or they wait. And I'm kind of struggling with this because if you look at what Bernanke's saying, that he's going to, you know, that this is really QE to infinity, and you look at all the arguments, one, how much the banks have to be bought, or what's happening with unemployment and the election. I think it's fair to say that that he could be printing a lot more. So if you look at the money that could get infused into the system in both Europe and here, it's pretty significant, and that argues that the price could be much higher. I think my high for the year was 1800 to 1850. So I expect to see it higher before the end of the year. At the same time, if you look at sort of the politics and the games around the budget negotiations after the election, that could argue for, you know, a massive correction of all tangible values across the board.
So I'm kind of...
What do you think would precipitate that? A massive correction?
What I think would precipitate it would be a really serious negotiation over recasting the budget. Go ahead. No, you go ahead. So I'm concerned because if you look at the U.S. economy and through it, the global economy. A great deal of the economy trades off of government money, government contracts, government purchases, and government credit. And if you want to recast the budget and to do that, you're going to scare everybody and pull a lot of money, then you can have a remarkable fiscal deflation. Anyway, so you could see fiscal policy scare up a very significant short-term deflation. Now, I think it would be politics, not real. But I think after the, you know, and there's no doubt, you know, I didn't mention during Money and Market, but this is a stunning, affirmation that the central bankers are going to support an Obama election. So I think the Republicans have just been thrown overboard is what it looks like. So, but after I'm assuming the part of the goal is to bail out the banks and get through the elections. But once that's done, you know, how much do they have to, or will they continue? Especially if they want to recast the budget with a big negotiation. And if you look at what they're doing with the trade policy, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or this idea of privatizing cities, or some of the things they've been angling to do on the municipal bankruptcies, it looks to me like they're getting ready for radical reengineering. And I'm assuming that's why they're fielding drones all over the country, so they can do that. So if that's coming, that's going to be extraordinary deflationary. And so I think the chances of a major correction across the board after the election for the next 12 months, you know, is a real possibility. So if you're going to, I go back to if I want to buy now, do I buy now ahead of the run-up because I'm confident it's going to be more by the end of the year, or do I wait and see if I get a major correction next year?
Well, I don't, you know, when you look at a chart and when you think about charts, what you see is all the information that everybody has about the price at that time and what they've known in the past. And you obviously work on the presumption that things will proceed in some kind of orderly fashion. If that's the case, then we've just completed that major correction. And
right,
gold and silver will be us for another 2 years at least. What I'm looking at is gold around, you know, above $2,300 by next June. And I don't usually give these numbers, but I certainly, if I look at time and gain, then I come up easily with those numbers, and $4,500 at the top of this particular way. So that's what I look at as possible. And I'm telling you something, and your listeners something right now, that I almost never say. And I'm glad you're arguing the other side on it. And that is, I almost never say, wait, I think you're close to a correction. It's just that this one seems obvious to me. Now, if gold went through $1,800 and got through, say, $1,850, I'd say, forget it. There isn't going to be a correction. Just, you know, it's going to run wild here for a while. But there's just so much resistance there. If you assume that the market is orderly, then you're going to get some kind of takedown from that level. I mean, we gained so much already, you know, from 27 to nearly $35 in silver, and from $1,600 really to $1,769. That's $170. That's a huge, huge gain in two or three weeks. So, but I mean, my long-term outlook hasn't changed, but I just cannot, I agree with you. If there were a fundamental re-engineering of the federal government budget, that would be a cause for me to say, whoa, you know, this, the time for silver and gold has ended. But I can't see them doing that. They'll talk about it. They may try to engineer prices lower by using that as their Blarney cannon. But
they won't
make that change. I don't think they can yet. There's not enough desperation.
Oh, I think they're coming up to a radical reengineering, but I think in terms of the general population and households, they would rather use a slow managed debasement than anything that goes too fast. So from a household standpoint, you know, it's going to be slow and painful. It's going to continue to be that way. So I'm with you. They're going to inflate, but so they're going to debase our income but raise our expenses, so to speak.
But there's no
what?
One little thing to sum up the whole gold and silver picture. There's no question now that the correction is over. The correction has ended. The correction has started in April 2011 in silver and September 2011 in gold. That's over. That's behind us. Now we're headed up again.
Okay, well, we've got a whole series of questions coming in from the listeners, so can I proceed with the questions?
Do.
Okay. We know that the precious metals markets are manipulated to hold the price of metals down, but how much can the price be manipulated? For example, could the powers that be have held the price of gold down to 500 of all all of this time if they had really wanted to?
No. I mean, the short answer is no. And even though I agree that they manipulate the price, the success of their manipulation is the same success any government program has. They have manipulated gold down from $252 to $1,770 today. That doesn't sound like success to me. It might have risen substantially faster had they not been manipulating it, but it's not, they cannot forever keep it down, I don't believe. I think the market's bigger than that. But I think you disagree with me, I don't know.
Well, my feeling is that they have more power to manipulate, I think, than you do, but it's gradations, it's not a black or white. And I don't think they could ever hold it down at 500 with this kind of monetary policy without dropping nuclear weapons. I mean, you'd have to have a nuclear war. So, you know, I always say that at some point the price clears with war instead of with price. And so I think the limitation on their ability to control it is that. Now, I also believe that derivatives have given them much more power to manage prices than I ever thought was conceivable without derivatives. So I think derivatives are a big piece of this. The other thing is, you know, I don't believe they want the price to stay low. I think they want to manage rise because, you know, I've said it 1,000 times, but I'm going to keep saying it as long as we get these questions, and that is, you know, once I've used fiat currency to steal everything and own everything, then I want sound currency. So I want to go back to gold and silver and sound currency because that helps me keep everything I've stolen. Another question, please compare other assets with metals. What balance should I have with other assets? Is it time to buy or sell out of any asset class?
Well, I'm not really the person to ask that question because I'm going to tell everybody put all of your assets except what is your major source of income, that is a productive asset, into silver and gold. I mean, that's my outlook. I know you have a different outlook. You look for stocks in particular industries that might do well. When I talk about stocks, I talk about the whole stock market, that is the stock market indices, is the terms I think in. And I don't want to hold any of those. But if you can Right. find particularly productive assets, your own business, a gas station, a restaurant, a farm, a factory, any of those things that produce an ongoing stream of revenue, then, of course, I'm in favor of owning that. It's just difficult to find those in the world of stocks where you've got well-managed companies not over-leveraged and, you know, that really that have the ability in the face of depression and recession to continue to produce a stream of income.
Well, I love great companies, so I'm an enterprise person in it. And my heart, you know, when I bumped into Bill Murphy and Gatta and trying to learn about gold, I was basically, in my heart, I was a stock person, and I still am. I always struggle with these questions because I cannot recommend a certain percentage in any asset without knowing a person. One of the things when you become an investment advisor, there are very strict rules about you can't give investment advice unless you have taken the time to understand a person's unique profile. And once you spend a lot of time with person after person getting to know their individual situations and then advising them on where they should allocate their assets, what you discover is that's very good advice. In other words, every person is different. But the one thing I say to everybody that I believe as strongly as possible, and that is your number one priority should be your health and making sure you have sources of food and water which can ensure that you have quality health for you and your family, number one. And then number two, you should be spending your money on anything that will permanently bring your overhead down, because the way to get out of the matrix is to have as little overhead as possible, because the more you have to generate an income through assets that are subject to complex rules and regulations, you know, so that you can live nicely. And I'm always stunned, Franklin, at the extent to which we've been intermediated, and we don't see the ability to sort of disintermediate and get the sort of the system out of our balance sheet and our income statement by, you know, doing more for ourselves and investing our money that way. So I would, on those two counts, I would say it's very important. And then, of course, anything you can do to command your own ability to generate your own income, whether it's you have properties or you have your own business and on, the more control you have and the less dependent, you know, you are on the system, I think the better. Now, that said, I think many of the problems of this world are going to have to be solved by entrepreneurs and new enterprises. So I do believe in that. But I think it's very difficult to, anybody tells you need a percentage in this and a percentage in that, as somebody who doesn't understand your unique situation. And if you take that advice, you come up with some very bizarre sort of financial plans. Another question, JP Morgan's 80% of 70 trillion derivatives are interest rate derivatives. Who's buying them and when will it end? Rob Kirby, the newsletter writer up in Canada, has done some great work on illuminating the explosion of interest rate derivatives. And I believe, Franklin, that that's been critical to managing interest rates down and sort of managing all prices, including the gold price. But when you look at the book of interest rate derivatives and see Ben Bernanke saying that he's going to keep interest rates at 0.25% through 2015, you kind of wonder if the derivatives book is, the interest rate derivatives are going to be a trillion. I don't even know what that is. Anyway, got any thoughts on how that's going to end?
Well, I have no doubt that there are enormous derivatives out there, enormous amounts of interest rate derivatives out there. I have no doubt that lots of them are underwater, which is probably one of the reasons that you're seeing these bailouts out of the Fed and the ECB. But, they're creating another problem that's so huge, I don't know how it can be solved. And that problem is pension funds work on an assumption of some kind of interest rate above 4%. And when the base rate goes to zero, they can't do anything. You know, I mean, they can't make enough money to pay what they have actuarially figured they're going to have to pay. So, but back to the derivatives, you know, the way I think of derivatives is they're leverage of leverage, which means that the power that you have in derivatives is far greater to move the price is far greater than selling the underlying selling or buying the underlying commodity, which in this case would be interest rates. So there's huge leverage there, and no doubt you can do a lot of control of the interest rates by that.
Well, we're getting ourselves into a real vise, because if you look at the pension funds and U.S. retirement accounts are the biggest holders of, obviously away from the Fed, the biggest holders of Treasury securities and the bank deposits that buy Treasury securities. And we see Basel III coming down the pike, and it's basically designed to make sure that small banks and the banking system have to loan to the government instead of to small business. And so we're watching a sucking sound of deposits and retirement accounts out of Main Street and into financing the government at a zero interest rate. And so the debasement is going to be that much more extraordinary, as you said. So this is a real financial drain on savers and retirees that is, I think, it's hard for people to understand the implications when they see Bernanke make these kinds of announcements. Because basically what you're doing is you're shooting enormous amounts of money into the banks to cover whether it's their mortgage-backed securities, their sovereign debt, or the derivatives, and the price will slowly be amortized by the pension funds, the retirees, and bank depositors who are holding money at 0%.
But I think except as a propaganda measure, has abandoned the zero interest rate policy, and the announcement today said that. right? Because, as I said, you can't have zero interest rates with one hand and print money with the other. You can do it for maybe a very short time, but eventually that's going to catch up with you. So I think, well, you know, maybe the deal here is we'll bail out the bank's bad assets. In Europe, they'll buy the sovereign bonds. And in the United States, the Fed will take the mortgage-backed assets or mortgage-backed securities. They'll clean up the bank's balance sheets, keep the interest rates low until then, and then let them rise. I don't know. I mean, that sounds plausible to me.
Well, I think they can keep them low for some time. The question is, how low can they keep them without war or violence? You know, when I get back to the drones headed out across the United States. I mean, I think that's why they want that kind of invasive control. Because when you require a whole society, whether it's their pension funds or their bank deposits, to basically be channeled into the government at 0%, that's a tax much greater than the income tax, ultimately. So, okay, here's the question I always get, Franklin, and I'm never quite sure what to say, but I'll ask it anyway, coming in from Australia. Why are they not able to make gold with alchemy?
Oh, you know, I've heard the stories that, you know, the Israelis had figured out a way to transmute other elements into gold and so forth. And I just don't think that's true. I mean, the physics of it are impossible. I mean, to be able to transmute one element to another, it's just impossible as far as I can tell.
Well, off and on, I have various scientists and inventors tell me it can be done and they can do it. And I keep saying, well, where's the beef? I don't think they can do it either. And if you look at all of the different politics and manipulations around the gold and silver price, you know, I would say to date, every indication is ain't no such thing. Not to say that people don't try and create it with titanium, but ain't no such thing. Okay, well, let me turn to, did you by any chance, one more question. What is the major reengineering? Is it a digital non-cash system? That's a good question because I think clearly the if you look at where the mobile apps and Apple and all these other things are going and bitcoins and the new mint chip cash and clearly, I think where the central bankers would like to go is a digital non-cash system, which would be the most centralizing and sort of worst thing for everybody else. But when I was saying a major reengineering, I mean a major reengineering of the federal budget, and that is now in America, 50% of every or more of the cash flows within a county, 50% of the households, the municipality, many of the businesses are basically directly dependent on U.S. government contracts, purchases, appropriations, programs, subsidies, and credit. It's enormous. And it's very, very controlling. And by that, I mean a reengineering of how that money is organized and allocated, including some major changes in various tax policies. So we'll talk about that more after the election, but a lot could happen next year on the federal budget. And if you look at the stories, do a search on fiscal cliff, you'll kind of see the powers that be working up to the question of the competition between retirees and the military and interest on the federal debt. And it's one of the reasons that what Franklin and I are talking about is interest rates is so sensitive, because if interest rates start to rise, there's going to be a real competition within the federal budget for those dollars going head-to-head with retirees. So Franklin, go ahead.
Okay, there was an article today. You'll love this. There was an article today in the Wall Street Journal, and it was about people who are, in the words of the FDIC, underbanked. Got that? Underbanked. 28% of people in this country, over 28%, don't use banks. And their payment cards, I wasn't even aware of this, called Green Dot cards, where you can go, uh-huh. You can actually have your paycheck downloaded to a to this card, and then take the card and spend it like a debit card. So I guess that's not a move away from the cashless society, but it's certainly a move against the banked society, because these numbers of, quote, underbanked people are rising, and they have been rising since 2009. Right. So in other words,
they're rising.
Right, that's exactly right. And so, you know, obviously a lot of those people use cash. They use cash and they buy money orders and things like that. But there are a number of other ways to avoid that system. But would they like to have a system where every payment goes through the same channel? You betcha they would. That's what the IRS right. has been trying to do since 1985.
Right.
Right, and that's exactly what we don't want, which is why, you know, one of the reasons I love using gold and silver, the idea of using gold and silver as a currency, is because it's offline. And just to remind everybody, if you haven't checked out the gold and silver payment calculator, Franklin came up with, said to me one day, you know, the problem most people have in using gold and silver as a currency is they don't have a calculator that can toggle back and forth between gold and silver and dollars or other currencies. And so he had made one, and he made a giant spreadsheet. And so we helped put it up online, and you can link to it from his website or from mine. It's called the silverandgoldormoney.com is the direct URL. And it's got a list of equivalents. If you click on equivalents, you can get a great list of all the bullion, gold, and silver coins and see what their melt value is. And sure enough, you can calculate back and forth between currencies and gold and silver. And so our theory is, if you want to do a community currency, and you can get an app for your iPhone and Android, but if you want to do a community currency, you don't need to have a meeting. You just need to start doing it. So it's really a brilliant little tool. So I would recommend you check it out on the web. Well,